I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, the best new towns to retire in. Some, like Bozeman, Montana, don't want it known. Oops. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court took the Bush administration's side today in a case involving state secrets, an issue the high court hasn't directly ruled on in 50 years. This morning, the court refused to hear a lawsuit brought by Khaled al-Masri, a German citizen who claims he was mistaken for a terrorist, kidnapped by CIA agents in Europe 4 years ago, and sent to a secret prison in Afghanistan, where he was tortured even after his interrogators realized they had the wrong man. The court did not take his case, effectively ending his lawsuit. Well, joining us live from Washington is Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times of London. And Dimitri, Khaled al-Masri's story has been widely covered in Europe. What does German Chancellor Angela Merkel say about his claim?
Well, the Germans have been very careful in discussing this publicly. They've essentially hinted that Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State here in the U.S., has admitted to the Germans that al-Masri was picked up mistakenly and was taken to Afghanistan. But they haven't made as huge a public fuss as they could, because they're also concerned about the implications for U.S.-German relations.
Well, we know that Angela Merkel said that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice admitted al-Masri had been erroneously taken. What has the White House said publicly?
The White House and the intelligence agencies in the U.S. are declining to basically admit to that. But privately, senior intelligence officials will say to you that that was the case. Al-Masri was picked up in 2003 in Macedonia and then spent about 5 months in a secret CIA prison in Afghanistan, where he claims he was tortured, sodomized, beaten.
Well, and President Bush has admitted to secret prisons. This was in a news conference a year ago. So what information might the administration want to keep secret?
Well, the al-Masri's lawyers say that the administration is trying to invoke what they call the state secrets privilege. And the lawyers for Masri say, well, hold on, this is a case that's been discussed all around the world. What could come out that's a secret? The administration says that the program, the secret renditions program, has only been discussed at a kind of a general level, and they're worried that details might emerge that the general public is not familiar with.
You mentioned state secrets. Let's remind ourselves, the court set precedent on this issue in 1953 after a military plane crashed and killed several researchers on board. Their families sued, but reports on the crash were withheld, citing state secrets. The Supreme Court at that time agreed, but as we've reported here, the daughter of one of those researchers discovered recently there were no state secrets, just poor maintenance. So it would seem that precedent is flawed. So what does the court base its decision on today, or do they even say?
It's impossible to know why the court decided not to take al-Masri's case. You need 4 out of the 9 Supreme Court justices to agree to hear a case. So clearly 4 of them didn't have 4 today. And this also, I would say, has implications for other cases that the court may or may not decide to hear later this term. For example, the American Civil Liberties Union is suing the National Security Agency over its secret wiretapping program. And again, in this case, the issue is also state secrets.
And what do you think the effect of the decision is? Is the Supreme Court saying the White House, and solely the White House, not the judicial branch, has the power to decide what should be made public about extraordinary renditions and secret prisons?
Well, it's very difficult to say when we don't have any documents or any hearings to base it on, but essentially they seem to have sided with the Bush administration, which is to err on the side of caution in allowing some of these cases to go ahead. Now, it may be possible that they will give a little bit more, they'll have a more skeptical approach when it comes to the secret wiretapping program, because that involves American citizens, whereas al-Masri is a German citizen. We're just going to have to wait and see.
Well, Khaled al-Masri was seeking $75,000 in damages. He has said he'd settle for an apology from the U.S. What happens now? Does he get anything, or does he have any recourse?
Essentially, he has no recourse unless the German government decides to try and raise it again at a senior level and have some kind of a remedy for Mr. Masri. I don't think anything's going to happen. But the problem for the administration is they don't want to admit to this publicly because of the legal implications, not just for the al-Masri case, but possibly for other people who have been brought through the renditions program and released, who may then try to sue the U.S. government. So they're afraid to admit anything.
Yeah. Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times of London. Dimitri, thank you as always.
Thank you, Robin. Take care.
Well, to retirement now, which doesn't mean what it used to. With all the talk of baby boomers not giving up their jobs, they are retiring far sooner than their grandparents in 1950, when, according to the Census Bureau, half of all men 65 and older were still working. Today, the number is about 19%. But researchers say that trend is reversing. Baby boomers are continuing to work part-time as they age, and they're choosing very different retirement towns than their grandparents did once they do fully retire. Move over, Florida. How about Smyrna, Tennessee, Fayetteville, Arizona, rather Fayetteville, Arkansas, or Bozeman, Montana? U.S. News & World Report is out with a new list of the best places to retire, and today we want to spend a few minutes on the top 10. Tim Smart is managing editor. He joins us now. And Tim, you started with a list of 2,000 communities with populations of 15,000 or more. How did you then winnow them down? What criteria did you use?
We looked at things like weather, the climate, access to health care, whether the place was close to a university or college, what the crime rate was, preferably lower the better, and general economic conditions, cost of living, that kind of thing.
How did you consider income level?
We looked at the cost of housing, and we had some other data on what the general income was in the area, but we focused pretty much on housing because that seems to be what people focus most on.
Well, let's get started. I mean, I said move over Florida, but it's still on the list. Venice, Florida, which is on the Gulf Coast, just above Naples. Here's one of the people that you spoke with, Roger Dooley, who retired there.
When I first decided to move here, I made a right on Venice Avenue, took the car straight here, and told my wife, this is where we're going to live. Never heard of the place before in my life, and I truly made a good choice on that.
Venice was founded as a company town, Tim?
It was founded originally, I think, by a union. They wanted a place for their workers to retire.
And it's got a real old feel. Your article, some would say the way Naples used to feel before they built it up. Is that a fear in Venice?
I think there's a fear everywhere in Florida that it's getting overbuilt. And it just so happens that Venice is one of those places that's done a pretty good job managing its growth.
Yeah, so it's got this real small town feel to it. Well, that seems to be a concern in a lot of the towns that you picked. In fact, on your top 10 list, Bozeman, Montana. And the first line of the story says the people in Bozeman didn't want the story published.
That's right. In fact, not just that they didn't want it published, but I think one of the people that the writer talked to in Bozeman after she spoke with our writer called back and said, don't put my name in the magazine because all the neighbors will come after me.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a fear that wealthy retirees are going to, you know, really drive up real estate prices.
I think this is a fear everywhere. All of the various places that have yet to be discovered or are just now being discovered, a lot of times they're being discovered because they're affordable, but you know what happens when something becomes popular, the price goes up.
Well, what's the appeal of Bozeman? We already know it because it's a beautiful town, but what would the appeal be to retirees?
It's extremely outdoorsy. I think it still has a pretty small town feel, and it's fairly hip. There's a fair number of people that have migrated there from California and elsewhere, you know, and they've brought with them their sort of high-tech mentality. So you've got a lot of sort of people working from home, and there's just, I think, a kind of a trendiness about it.
But again, there's just this fear, you know, that they're going to lose their character. And you write about the same fear in Prescott, Arizona. This is high in the Sonoran Desert. It's much cooler than Phoenix. But interestingly, some retirees there were behind a push for sustainable growth, and they won. They reined in development there.
They did, and I think that will happen, you know, many of these places. I mean, Prescott is kind of downmarket Sedona. I hope they don't hear that in Prescott and get mad at me. But, you know, it is kind of like you get the benefits of a place like Sedona at considerably less cost.
Well, too late, because they did hear it in Prescott, Arizona. But, you know, the beauty of Prescott, it's got beautiful forests and trees and greenery. But it has a couple drawbacks for people who are older. What are they?
Well, it's at a pretty high elevation, and obviously that would be a problem if somebody had breathing difficulties. And it's a fair distance from, you know, top-grade health care, which is increasingly a concern for people considering where to retire.
Yeah, I think 3 hours to the airport there. Skipping around again, you mentioned weather was one of your considerations. Hillsboro, Oregon, it rains a lot there, but people love it.
Well, it rains a lot, that's true. But one thing the rain brings you is a lush climate and a lot of greenery. And for people that are, you know, into gardening and things like that, growing grapes, there are wineries in the area. So it's very good for that kind of thing, fertile soil. You know, some people don't mind the rain.
Yeah. And some people don't mind the cold. Concord, New Hampshire, just north of where we are in Boston, also in your top 10 list. In fact, you speak with a couple Peter and Meg Scheller, who retired to Concord from California. Why?
The main thing that attracted them to Concord was to be near family, and they also felt that there was a real kind of cohesive community there. They thought in California, you know, you really didn't get to know your neighbors very well, and apparently the cold doesn't bother them. Of course, summers are lovely in Concord.
Well, we'd say winters are gorgeous as well. Is that a part of why people look for a retirement place? They want something different.
I think it's almost like a perpetual vacation when they first decide to move, those that decide to move somewhere. I think they're looking for something different than from where they've, you know, come from. And if they've grown up on the East Coast, they might be looking to go to the Southwest. If they're from California, they might be looking to go inland, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Fayetteville, Arkansas. It's a town that's home to the University of Arkansas, an area that's really booming. Now, how often do retirees go to a college town?
College towns are actually increasingly popular with retirees. You know, a lot of college towns have invested a lot of money in building the infrastructure to support the economy around them. And so you often have good opportunities for part-time work if you want to work in retirement. Plus, I think there's just the intellectual stimulation that comes from being around people of different age groups.
Right. Here's Mitch Singleton. He's a retired ophthalmologist and retired to Fayetteville.
It's really great to be in a university community. You have theater, you have music, you have the intellectual stimulation.
So there you go. Lawrence, Kansas, another college town. And not the part of Kansas, you know, that we think of, you know, corn-covered prairie.
And Kansas, of course, is famous as a sort of Republican bedrock state. But actually, Lawrence, Kansas is, if you pardon the phrase, one of the liberal outposts in Kansas. So, you know, it's a little different mentality, perhaps a little different culturally than the rest of Kansas, and that appeals.
It's lush and green, and again, it has the, you know, attraction of the university. You know, we used to think that retirement was all about golf. You know, and as you've been saying, it's rock climbing, it's hiking, it's, you know, people going out west, people going to the northeast, people looking for other things. But there's still one place on your list, Peachtree, Georgia. 9,000 registered golf carts?
Yes, but they use the golf carts to get around. I'm sure they use them on the golf courses too. But it's funny, we have a picture of a golf cart, and they use them on these sort of trails as their basic mode of transportation instead of the car.
They link the Peachtree City's five villages, and they drive around on these golf carts. Anyone over 16 can drive without a license.
That's appealing, I think, to some retirees. I know as people age, sometimes they get a little fearful about driving, particularly in crowded, you know, cities. And, you know, if you can ride drive a golf cart around, it might be easier on you.
Tim Smart, managing editor for U.S. News & World Report. Their magazine is out with a special report on retirement, including a top 10 list of the best places in America to retire. We know real estate agents are listening very closely because we keep hearing from them. Please let my town be on the list. When we come back, some of the best bargain locations for retirement, places like Yuma, Arizona. And later in the program, don't forget, Fred Thompson will stand shoulder to shoulder later today with other Republican presidential candidates. It's going to be a first for him. How will he measure up? We'll speak to a reporter who's been on the trail with the Thompson campaign. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Back after a one-minute break here and now. We're back with more of our conversation about retirement with Tim Smart. He's managing editor of U.S. News & World Report. The magazine is out with its top 10 list of the best places in America to retire. Actually, there are many different lists in the issue besides the top 10, and you can see them all by going to our website, here-now.org. All sorts of interesting nominees on the lists, from State College, Pennsylvania, to Concord, New Hampshire, and interesting different categories, such as the best bargain spots to retire. On that list, there's Fredericksburg, Texas. This is in the hill country of Texas, about an hour's drive from Austin or San Antonio. There's no state income tax in Texas. There's Boone, North Carolina, about 100 miles from Charlotte. Tim, you say the cost of living there is 11% below the U.S. average. You also include Yuma, Arizona. Thousands of snowbird retirees spend their winters there because of the warm weather. But why is Yuma a year-round bargain?
It's very popular with people from California that retire there because it's fairly close to the California line. And people from California come there, and for the price of what I think a gentleman told us he would pay for a margarita in San Diego, he now can get a full meal in Yuma, Arizona.
Huh. And you also had readers offer their retirement ideas. I love some of these. Aiken, South Carolina, John Buchanan writes, there are 4,800 horses and only 22,000 people and 48 polo fields. So if you're interested in polo. And from Green Valley, Arizona, Harriet Davidson writes about trails, woodland trails filled with bird life. So there's, you know, all different reasons why people are picking places.
One of the things from the reader's suggestions that I found so interesting was the passion with which they expressed their choice of place that they live and that they retired to. Although it's interesting, we didn't put it in the magazine, but one of the readers wrote in and said that her favorite place to retire was her back porch.
Well, speaking of which, I mean, some, you know, people plan on staying home, but someone else wrote in and said, my favorite retirement spot will be the USA. They're going to get a motorhome.
Very popular thing to do if you go driving on I-95 on the weekends up and down the East Coast. You'll just see caravans of motorhomes, and often the people behind the wheel will appear to be, you know, of retirement age. You know, it's mobility. I think that's a key thing. Retirees, particularly the younger retirees, the baby boomers that are retiring, see themselves as very mobile. An RV is the ultimate mobility.
Well, San Francisco is the only really big city on your top 10. It's a very expensive city to live in. I mean, it's a great city, but what would be the appeal? What kind of retirees are going to San Francisco?
Well, I think it appeals to people who have perhaps in their life lived in a big city and miss it. Maybe they grew up or worked at an early age in Manhattan. And so they need that energy. They need that buzz of the big city. They need the different ethnic eateries. They need the museums, the theater, concerts, and just the hustle and bustle. Some people really prefer that to the quiet life.
We're seeing this here in Boston as well. These might be people who are giving up big homes and becoming condo dwellers, and even hotel condos.
That's true. I think, you know, there was a period when people were expanding their families and, you know, having large houses, even McMansions, as they call them. And, you know, a lot of people realize how much work that is. Even if you hire somebody to do the work, it still is work to manage a big home. So they're finding that they'd rather have something less, fewer chores to do around the home and more time to read or go to museums or whatever.
You also give retirement information. Could you give us some of the tips that you share with people who, you know, are thinking, retirement, I can't even pay my mortgage, you know. What are some tips for planning ahead?
Right. Well, on our website, we have quite a bit of information on retirement. We have retirement tips for 20-somethings. We have is a Roth 401k for you, which is a new type of 401k that some companies are offering their employees. And then the other thing on our website, if you really just want to sort of exercise your brain around the idea of retirement in the future, we have an online search capability that you can plug in the kind of things that matter most to you, if you want to be in a hot place or a cold place, if you want to be in the West or the East, and you can essentially draw up your own list of best places.
Okay, so there's that. But we also want to, you know, just before we let you go, just give a quick nod to the runners-up. We gave the top 10, but there's 10 runners-up. One is sounds wonderful, Anacortes, Washington. It's on Fidalgo Island.
That's right, and Mount Airy looms above the Four Lakes. There's 3,000 acres of city-owned forests, and it, you know, overlooks the Puget Sound. And actually, it's not as rainy as Seattle, even though it's quite close.
Okay, and give us just a few of the others. Danville, Kentucky. It has the annual hot air balloon race at the Great American Brass Band Festival. Geneva, Illinois.
You know, there are people who don't think of the Midwest as a retirement spot, but there are plenty of places in the Midwest that are appealing, and Geneva is one of them. It has shady streets lined with century-old homes, and, you know, there's an extensive bike trail system there, forest preserve. So it appeals to those that are looking for outdoors fun as well.
Yeah. You point out Juneau, Alaska isn't as cold as people think. It only it averages 21 degrees in January, and that's not all that bad. And you point out that there's well-known places in Hawaii, but take a look at Kailua. Is that how you say it? Kailua, Hawaii.
Kailua, Hawaii. It's separated by a tunnel from Honolulu. And, of course, you've got those lovely tropical ocean breezes, and who can beat the weather in Hawaii?
And one last nod to State College, Pennsylvania, because Penn State is there, and retirees can enroll in classes free of charge.
That's right, and they don't have to worry about exams or grades. How's that for going back to school? And, of course, you know, if you want to watch a football game, Penn State's a pretty good football team, too.
Tim Smart, managing editor at U.S. News and World Report, the magazine out with a special report on retirement, including a list of the top 10 places to retire, and as we just said, runners-up as well. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
And this note about the pressure that the baby boom generation will put on the Social Security system when they retire. More than 3 million baby boomers will turn 62 next year. And according to USA Today, about half of them are expected to begin drawing their monthly Social Security checks, even if they continue to work part-time. That's 75% of the benefit they would be entitled to if they waited four more years and retired at age 66. By the year 2030, Social Security's caseload will be 84 million people, up from 50 million today. And when you crunch the numbers of older and partly retired workers versus younger workers, that will mean just about two workers will be paying payroll taxes for each retiree. Compare that to 1945, 10 years after Social Security was created. At that point, there were 42 workers paying into the system for every retiree. Something to think about as you choose where you might retire. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, scientists perfecting bug-sized video surveillance cameras. Might they be buzzing to a city near you? That's tomorrow. And still ahead, a look at Fred Thompson's presidential bid. Later today in Dearborn, Michigan, former actor Fred Thompson takes the stage to audition for what may be the role of his life, President of the United States. Thompson hasn't formally debated since his campaign for U.S. Senator from Tennessee back in the mid-90s. Today's will be his first national Republican presidential debate. The politician turned lobbyist turned thespian turned GOP hopeful entered the presidential race just a month ago, but is polling well among likely Republican voters, second only to Mitt Romney in Iowa. He skipped earlier GOP debates in one case to appear on the Jay Leno show. And his style on the campaign trail has been so low-key he had to ask for applause in Marshalltown, Iowa, which became grist for the Saturday Night Live Mill this past weekend.
How badly do I want to be your president? On a scale of 1 to 10, I'm about a 6. I'm not saying I don't want to be your president, because I kind of do. A little bit. It's just, how do you campaign when you don't like hard work and people make you sick? I'd like to finish by letting you know that I intend to treat my time in the White House like my time at Law and Order. I'm in the opening credits, but not all the scenes. Do you not give me any applause on that one?
David Whitford is editor-at-large for Fortune magazine. He spent part of last week with the Thompson campaign in Iowa, and he joins us now in the studios. David, do you think that his handlers are going to be showing him that video before today?
Oh, I'm sure they already have.
Yeah.
It's no secret that Fred Thompson has been a lackluster campaigner. I think there was an expectation when he joined the race that he's an actor, that he has all this experience in front of people, that he has charisma, supposedly, and that he would wow people on the campaign trail. And, of course, that hasn't been the case. I mean, the conventional wisdom now is true, that he stumbles over his words, that he appears to be lazy, that he, rather than drawing energy from the crowd, he sucks the energy out, I think, and then it dissipates in the room.
Well, what happened? You were there in Marshalltown. What happened?
Well, you know, it was the second event of the day. It was a dreary room, a supper club in Marshalltown, and he finished talking, and he hasn't figured it out yet, you know, how to do this thing on the stump to come to the rousing conclusion and make it obvious that people have to applaud for him. And so it's true. He stood up there and he said, "Can I have a round of applause?" But I believe that all of this, far from undermining his campaign, I think it is endearing him in some ways to people. When Fred Thompson stands up there, he's not striving. He's not, you know, a pretty boy by any means. And I think that gives people some comfort. It's almost a kind of sweet thing, you know, mm-hmm. when you ask for people to applaud for you. And I think that people may respond to that in a positive way. I think it's beside the point, really, in terms of his popularity.
Well, I mean, you know, again, we look at the polls, and he's doing quite well going into Iowa where this happened. What is it then? I mean, besides the, some sort of maybe psychological, you know, that he's not too slick and he, you know, maybe he's making people feel comfortable in that way. But what else is the draw?
We'll learn more about Fred Thompson and his credibility, I think, after the debate later today. But right now, the case that Thompson's advisors make is that, look, this election is going to turn on one issue, and that's national security. And they believe that their man, even more than Rudy Giuliani, can give voters the comfort that they crave, that this is someone who can take care of us. You know, this is somebody who can look out for us in this age of terrorism.
But hasn't he stumbled on some of those issues? I mean, you know, for instance, the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, he has. What he said about Osama bin Laden is that whether Osama is at large or not at large is not the main issue now. The issue is al-Qaeda. I don't think that those kind of stumbles upset people as much as pundits may think they do. I think that fundamentally, he has an emotional appeal to a certain category of voter. And they don't really care what Fred Thompson's, you know, 10-point plan is for combating terrorism. They don't care about slip-ups that he may make because I think they make those slip-ups themselves.
Well, and in fact, the debate tonight is on the economy, and he seems to be taking advantage of that feedback he might be getting from the audience that they don't care, because that's the language he's used about the economy on the trail. I don't care about the other candidates. They have 10-point, 15-point plans.
Right.
He says things like that. So what is the take on him, for instance, on the economy?
Well, at a certain point, he's going to have to get a little bit more specific. I mean, basically what he's been saying on the campaign trail so far is, look, I'm for smaller government and lower taxes. I mean, basic meat and potatoes Republican approach.
I'll do what Reagan does.
Exactly.
Or did.
Yeah. And, you know, when he goes into details beyond that, he'll talk about the viability, long-term viability of the Social Security system, of Medicare, Medicaid, and he'll talk about the need to address this looming fiscal crisis. And he tries to make the case that he's somebody who is willing to speak the truth on those issues. Mm-hmm. I think tonight we might hear a little bit more detail. You know, he's for lower taxes, of course. And one of his top economic advisors is this fellow Larry Lindsey, who was a top economic advisor to President Bush and lost his job when he made the outrageous prediction that the Iraq war would cost $200 billion. We're three times past that now. Mm-hmm. He lost his job as a result. But Larry Lindsey is a realist on how much things cost and has been working with Fred Thompson on developing a tax plan. And I think we may hear some details of that today.
May we also hear tonight about a little of his own biography. We know he came from relatively modest background. He married his high school sweetheart when she became pregnant, and that sort of derailed his career because the high school back then wouldn't let him play sports. But he married into a family that put him back on another track.
That's right. Derailed one track and put him on probably a better track. His own father was a used car salesman. His grandfather was a sharecropper. He has joked on the campaign trail that he doesn't want to look too far back in his own family history because he's a little bit afraid about what he might find there. Mm-hmm. The family that he married into, the grandfather especially was a prominent lawyer in town and got Fred Thompson interested in a legal career. And that's what helped raise him out of what had been modest circumstances.
And yet, his second wife, Jerry Thompson, who was a Republican operative who's a good deal younger than him, she's 41, he's 65, has now caused some controversy on the campaign trail. She's seen as perhaps a trophy wife. He has a very different image on the trail. So can he bring up that old story while he's living the new?
Yeah, Jerry Thompson is a fascinating person, and they make an interesting pair. When she stands up there next to him while he's giving his speeches, you know, he's an older man. And, you know, a lot of 65-year-old actors may look really well-preserved. Fred Thompson looks 65, at least. His wife doesn't look as old as she is. She exudes vitality, youth, and energy. And I think that probably will help him a lot.
Well, either way, whether it does or doesn't, so it begins. America really starts to meet Fred Thompson this afternoon.
That's right. He skipped the first debate after he announced his candidacy. He chose instead to run a campaign advertisement and to announce his candidacy later that night on the Jay Leno show. Tonight, for the first time, he stands up there face to face with Romney, Giuliani, McCain, and the others, and we'll get a chance to see, A, you know, what he looks like standing up there next to these people, and B, how he responds to specific questions about what he has in mind for the country.
David Whitford, editor-at-large for Fortune magazine. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
We have a few seconds here for a reminder that you can listen to today's show stream live at our website, here-now.org. For past programs, click on the archives, and you can always download a podcast and take us with you when you go, here-now.org. But we hope you don't go yet, because still to come, actress Valerie Harper unplating Golda Meir, Henry Kissinger, Moshe Dayan, and much more in her new film. Oh, a little on playing Rhoda Morgenstern as well. You're listening to Here and Now. vacancy mayor for hire. An Atlantic City fireman is suggesting that the New Jersey City take out that ad to find a replacement for its mayor. The mayor, Robert Levy, has not been seen in public for nearly 2 weeks, and no one knows where he is. After Levy just stopped coming to work, his office issued a one-sentence statement saying the mayor was away for medical reasons. The city administrator says the mayor left him in charge. City councilors are arguing that claim in court, and last week, community activists tried to storm the mayor's office to get some answers. WHYY reporter Susan Phillips has been following this story. Susan, the mayor's disappearance is said to be connected to an investigation into his false claim that he was a member of the Green Berets. Tell us more about that.
That's right. The U.S. Attorney's Office is not talking about this directly, but it has been reported that he is the subject of a federal investigation. And the issue is he is a decorated Vietnam War veteran, but he's been telling everyone that he was also a member of the Green Berets. Newspaper reports last year revealed that that was not true. He's admitted it's not true. But folks are saying that there is an investigation into whether he did indeed collect $25,000 in military benefits that he wasn't allowed to.
Well, you've spoken with the mayor's attorney. What does he say?
The mayor's attorney isn't saying anything. He's saying that he's going to say something either today or tomorrow.
Right. Well, what is the law? We know City Councilman Bruce Ward has filed a suit in County Superior Court asking for a judgment that Levy has vacated his office.
The law is very murky. I spoke to Bruce Ward, and he's in court today, actually, trying to convince the judge that the judge should declare the seat vacant. And once the judge declares the seat vacant, then the seat is open for somebody to step in on an interim basis until there's a special election. But everything's pretty murky. City Councilman Bruce Ward says that the city council president will be the one to step in.
This is William Marsh.
That's
well,
right.
By the way, Bruce Ward is a longtime friend of the mayor. What is he saying about his disappearance?
He says he was pretty shocked. I mean, Bruce Ward went to high school with the mayor. He basically described him as one of the guys. And he described the whole incident as just bizarre and overwhelming.
And it sounds like sort of sad because he was well-liked and respected just for being a veteran.
That's right. You know, Bruce Ward himself said to me he was scared to go to Vietnam. That's why he went to college. And so he had a lot of respect for the mayor. He felt like he could be a decent mayor because he had run, you know, Atlantic City's beach patrol and in charge of the emergency management office down there. So he's pretty shocked about what's happening.
Well, although this is a city used to scandals, the New York Times reports that five mayors in the last 40 years have either pled guilty or been convicted of crimes. The city council president is currently in jail. And we understand a third of the council members last year had resigned for corruption charges?
That's right. In fact, and of course, it's the former city council president at this point, but that's right. It does have a history of corruption. There's no doubt about it. When I was speaking to Bruce Ward yesterday, you know, he was saying how concerned he was about the reputation, not just nationally, but internationally. I mean, they're getting a lot of international press as well. You know, one of the mayor, Bob Levy's best friends, an assemblyman named Jim Whalen, they've been close to each other, you know, for most of their lives, talked to me yesterday and said he's definitely wants Bob Levy to resign, that this has gone on too long.
A couple last quick questions, Susan. We mentioned that City Administrator Dominic Capella says that the mayor left him in charge. Are people accepting that?
No, not at all. In fact, that's why they're in court right now today. City Council hasn't accepted that. A lot of activists and residents of Atlantic City aren't accepting that. Dominic Capella has sent a memorandum out to City Council members saying that Bob Levy verbally gave him authorization to be acting mayor. They think that's not good enough. They wanted it in writing from the mayor himself. Mm. But nobody's saying where the mayor is. I mean, there's rumors flying around that he's in the hospital, that he's possibly in rehab for drugs or alcohol, but nobody really knows. So they're saying that this man, Dominic Capella, who is not an elected official, doesn't have the right to just step in and take over if the mayor's disappeared.
WHYY reporter Susan Phillips. Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And still to come, her characters include Rhoda Morgenstern and Golda Meir. We'll speak with actress Valerie Harper. That's still to come here and now. Thank you. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It's October 1973. A match strikes on a dark stage. Cigarette smoke begins to curl, and the bowed head of Golda Meir lifts to face the audience.
The picture you may have of me, Mama La Golda, who makes chicken soup for her soldiers. It's a nice picture. And I do make chicken soup. But let's empty it all out for keeps right now. At the bottom of the pot is blood.
It's going to be a long night. The Yom Kippur War is about to erupt. The Prime Minister is at a crossroads. Be ready to defend the Israeli nation she helped found or launch a preemptive strike against Syria. Either path will lead to bloodshed and possibly nuclear annihilation.
I started out to make this state a model for the redemption of the human race. And now I face wiping out cities full of good people I never met. I wanted power to do good, but this power, this choice, has everything I've done for the past 70 years made this inescapable. What happens when idealism becomes power?
That's Valerie Harper, starring in a new film version of Golda's Balcony, the Broadway play which originally starred Tova Feldshuh but featured Valerie in a touring version. In the film, Harper takes on dozens of roles, from Golda Meir's father barring the door against pogroms in Kiev, to Israeli Minister Moshe Dayan urging her to show restraint against bombings, to Henry Kissinger dangling the promise of help from the sidelines. Valerie Harper? Mary Tyler Moore's neighbor Rhoda as the Russian-born, Milwaukee-bred Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir? Yes. And she joins us now from NPR in New York. Welcome.
Robin, it's great to be with you. And I can't say how moved I am. You picked exactly William Gibson's note to the world. That's what the playwright wrote. You just picked the two quotes that are the synthesis of the play, of the movie.
Okay, we can stop now.
No, it was great. I just was so moved by it.
Well, William Gibson, you mentioned, of course, he wrote The Miracle Worker, wrote right. Golda's Balcony, and you, an American treasure as an actress, and here you are transformed. You are physically Golda Meir here. How
sure,
did you get inside her?
Reading her biography, My Life by Golda Meir is a wonderful, wonderful piece. Also, all kinds of archival material. She was someone who was covered, so there was lots of radio interviews and all kinds of television. So I could really see who she was and hear her, and I tried to replicate her voice.
Well, the play follows the political crisis in 1973. There's also the backstory of Golda Meir's life in Milwaukee and her role in the founding of the State of Israel. She returns to America and raises $50 million from American Jews for guns to arm the first Israeli Defense Force. In this scene, we hear you as an American celebrating Golda's role, then you as Golda reflecting on it.
When history is written, it will say there was a Jewish woman got the money that made the state possible.
For guns. I begin with the redemption of the human race and end up in the munitions business.
Valerie Harper, tell us about that, this conflict that she seemed to have.
It was that we will not go easily to any kind of horrible fate again. There's a new Jew emerging, one with a state. And when we have a state, we can sit at the table of nations and participate and make the whole world much safer for Jews who've been under siege for a millennium. So she was very strong on that, but wanted peace. So negotiation was what she was really committed to, but she took a hard line on defense. It's not about attacking people. It's about holding that line in the sand.
As we know, just to remind ourselves of the history, the UN sanctioned the State of Israel in 1948. The next day, Israel was attacked by its Arab neighbors in 1973. They're on the verge of attack again. And part of the storyline is Golda Meir not knowing if Henry Kissinger and the Americans were going to come through with the support that they had promised.
That's right. There was about 3 days days of material left in the pipeline that was going to run out, and they had to know that more planes and munitions, conventional weapons, were coming where they could defend themselves. Otherwise, the generals were really talking about, you know, sending missiles to both Cairo and Damascus.
She also takes a secret trip wrapped in a head covering to meet with King Abdullah of then Transjordan. He wants her and the Jews to join his parliament. She says, no, that's what the last guy said, and then into the ovens. So we see her, you know, interacting with all of these different people, and all of these different people are you.
That's how the play was structured. It is Mr. Gibson's play, but it is done with archival footage and artwork and very lot of bells and whistles that you can only do in cinema. But because it's a memory play, Robin, all the people in our memory, we hear them through our filter. So everybody is Golda. Everybody is Robin when you remember, you know?
Well, here's, in fact, a clip of you as Golda Meir and also as Henry Kissinger. She's profoundly disappointed in the speed at which Henry Kissinger is fulfilling his promise to the Israelis.
He warned me.
First of all, I am an American. Secondly, I am Secretary of State of the United States. And lastly, I am a Jew.
That's fine. We read from right to left. This American wants Israel to come out on top, but he thinks it's good if we bleed a little first.
You know, I found myself thinking, okay, what was true and what wasn't true, because it has a documentary feel, but it's an entertaining film. So where might there have been license?
Well, you even played the quote. What happens when idealism becomes power? It kills. William Gibson said he doesn't think that Golda would have said that. She would have said, yes, you keep your idealism, and we're going to defend this to the last Jew. We will defend what we've brought into being. So the playwright was asking the question.
What's the answer, though? Is this a defense of the tactics she took on that night in October 1973, or should she have been
well,
more?
Well, they didn't do it. They didn't do it. And I've heard from Yadlin, who was her minister of education. He said, Valerie, I swear to you, it was 5 minutes, and the generals were saying, go, go, go.
Bomb.
And yes, she's saying, no. I want to get a no from Kissinger. I've got to. We were on the brink, kiddo. I mean, if they bombed, then perhaps Moscow would have bombed New York, or we would have bombed Moscow. Or, I mean, because there was such a linkage between Russian and America fighting their war in the Middle East. But it was really touch and go. So it was her restraint, actually, that prevented it. And also, it's Teddy Roosevelt. Speak softly with the big stick. And the big stick was this hidden arsenal that Israelis to this day deny, which is so interesting. They were so used to not talking about it that when they saw the movie at the Eilat Film Festival, they went, oh my gosh,
because
it's up there on the screen.
Because yeah. in the film, the character does talk about the nuclear facility, Dimona, mm-hmm. in Israel.
Which is long gone and moved and so forth.
Valerie Harper, you know, there are people who think you are Jewish because of... Right?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Are you?
Rhoda Morgenstern. No, I'm not. No.
So isn't that funny, because you came to represent for a lot of Americans the first time they ever saw a Jewish person because of Rhoda and the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
And the success of that show and the level of the writing. It's been the wind in the sails of my career, so I'm fine with that. And when little Jewish ladies grab my cheeks and say, oh, sweetheart, darling, I heard you weren't Jewish. Say it isn't so. And I say, well, in my heart, I am. And if you go back far enough, we're all Jewish.
Valerie Harper stars in Golda's Balcony, a film version of the Broadway play. The film opens in New York and Los Angeles this week, nationwide the month of October. For more on both Valerie and the film, go to our website, here-now.org. Valerie, it's always, always nice to check in and see what you are doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. It's been my pleasure.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.